Chapter 77 Pibin and Sylvie. She awaited him as he led Tycho up the trail emerging out of the valley of caves. She sat patiently next to an overhanging phip pine, just beyond a switchback, and only spoke when he drew even.
"Thought you'd just sneak out without saying goodbye, did you?" Sylvie asked.
She wore a long skirt and kept her arms wrapped around her knees. He tied the horse's tether to a tree limb and sat down next to her.
"Nah," Pibin said. "I knew I wouldn't be so lucky."
She glanced at him sidelong and saw that he was grinning. Sylvie sniffed and looked back into the canyon, where the early mists were slowly evaporating into a morning that promised to be clear and cloudless.
"I figured you'd be heading back."
"I have to, Sylvie. It's..."
She cut him off.
"I know. Responsibility. You have to get back to Galet. She needs you, Pibin."
He nodded. Pibin didn't have to be reminded that he still had a duty to Sylvie as well.
Dr. Sue came by while I was packing.
You filled the bottle she gave you, I know."
Sylvie bowed her head.
"Thank you. I consider myself well paid."
Pibin looked down. He felt awkward talking around the edges of the topic like this.
"When will you?"
"Tonight, I guess. I'm ready. Can't you tell?"
Sylvie's parka and long skirt certainly hid any outward signs. Still, she was right. Her scent was undisguised.
"I sincerely hope you get what you want, Sylvie."
She nodded again. They sat there awkwardly. Pibin tried to think of something to say, but he felt thick-headed, stupid. Whatever he tried, he knew, would surely turn out all wrong. Suddenly there was a small rustle of motion down below, where the switchbacks diverged into paths, leading in several directions. A tall human form emerged around a rocky bend, jogging tirelessly. Robert Oneagle ran toward a junction in the narrow trails, carrying only his bow and a light backpack. He glanced upward, and on spotting the two Chims, he slowed. Robert grinned in response as Pibin waved. But on reaching the fork, he turned southward along a little used track. Soon he had disappeared into the wild forest.
"What's he doing?" Sylvie asked.
"Looked like he was running."
She slapped his shoulder.
"I could see that. Where is he going?"
"He's gonna try to make it through the passes before it snows."
"Through the passes? But..."
"Since Major Prathachilthorn disappeared, and since time is so short, Lieutenant McHugh and the other Marines agreed they'd go along with the alternative plan Robert and Athaclena have cooked up."
"But he's running south," Sylvie said.
Robert had taken the little used trail that led deeper into the Moulin Range. Pibin nodded.
"He's going looking for somebody. He's the only one who can do the job."
It was obvious to Sylvie from his tone that that was all he would say about the matter. They sat there for a little while longer in silence. At least Robert's brief passage had brought a welcome break in the tension.
"This is silly," Pibin thought.
He liked Sylvie a lot. They had never had much chance to talk, and this might be their last opportunity.
You never did tell me about your first baby,"
he said in a rush. Wondering, as the words came out, if it was any of his business to ask. Of course, it was obvious that Sylvie had given birth before and nursed. Stretch marks were signs of attractiveness in a race a quarter of whose females never bred at all.
"But there is pain there as well," he knew.
"It was 5 years ago. I was very young."
Her voice was level, controlled.
His name was... We called him Sishi. He was tested by the board, as usual, but he was found anomalous.
Anomalous?
Yes, that was the word they used. They classified him superior in some respects, odd in others. There were no obvious defects, but some strange qualities, they said. A couple of the officials were concerned. The uplift board decided they'd have to send him to Earth for further evaluation. They were very nice about it.
She sniffed.
They offered me the choice of coming along.
Fibbon blinked.
You didn't go, though.
She glanced at him.
I know what you're thinking. I'm terrible. That's why I never told you before. You'd have refused our deal. You think I'm an unfit mother.
No, I...
At the time, it seemed different, though. My mother was ill. We didn't have a clan family, and I didn't feel I could just leave her in the care of strangers and probably never see her again. I was only a yellow card at the time. I knew my child would get a good home on Earth, or either he'd find favored treatment and be raised in a high-caste neo-chimp home, or he'd meet a fate I didn't want to know. I was so worried we would go all that way, and they would only take him away anyway. I guess I also dreaded the shame if he was declared a probationer.
She stared down at her hands.
I couldn't decide, so I tried to get advice. There was this counselor in Port Helena, a human with the local uplift board. He told me what he thought the odds were. He said he was sure I'd given birth to a probie. I stayed behind when they took Sichi away. Six months later, my mother died.
She looked up at Fibbon.
And then, 3 years after that, word came back from Earth. The news was that my baby was now a happy, well-adjusted little blue card, growing up in a loving blue card family, and... Oh, yeah. I was to be promoted to green.
Her hands clenched.
Oh, how I hated that damned card. They took me off compulsory yearly contraceptive injections, so I didn't have to ask permission anymore if I wanted to conceive again. Trusted me to control my own fertility, like an adult.
She snorted.
Like an adult? A chimmy who abandons her own child? They ignore that and promote me because he passes some damn tests.
So, Fibbon thought. This was the reason for her bitterness and for her early collaboration with the Gubru. Much was explained.
You joined Iron Grip's band out of resentment against the system? Because you hoped things might be different under the Galactics?
Something like that, maybe. Or maybe I was just angry.
Sylvie shrugged.
Anyway, after a while I realized something.
What was that?
I realized that however bad the system was under humans, it could only be far worse under the Galactics. The humans are arrogant, all right, but at least a lot of them feel guilty over their arrogance. They try to temper it. Their horrible history taught them to be wary of
hubris.
Yeah. They know what a trap it can be, acting like gods, and coming to believe it's true. But the Galactics are used to this meddlesome business. It never occurs to them to have any doubts. They're so damned smug. I hate them.
Fibbon thought about it. He had learned much during the last few months, and he figured Sylvie might be stating her case a little too strongly. Right now, she sounded a lot like Major Pratha Chulthorn. But Fibbon knew there were quite a few galactic patron races who had reputations for kindness and decency. Still, it was not his place to judge her bitterness. Now he understood her nearly single-minded determination to have a child who would be at least a green card from the very start. There had to be no question.
She wanted to keep her next baby, and to be sure of grandchildren.
Sitting there next to her, Fibbon was uncomfortably certain of Sylvie's present condition. Unlike human females, chimmies had set cycles of receptivity, and it took some effort to hide them. It was one reason for some of the social and family differences between the two cousin species. He felt guilty to be aroused by her condition. A soft, poignant feeling lay over the moment, and he was determined not to spoil it by being insensitive. Fibbon wished he could console her somehow, and yet he did not know what to offer her. He moistened his lips.
Look, Sylvie.
She turned.
Yes, Fibbon?
I really do hope you get... I hope I left enough...
His face felt warm. She smiled.
Dr. Sue says there probably was. If not, there's more where that came from.
He shook his head.
Your confidence is appreciated, but I wouldn't bet I'll ever be back again.
He looked away toward the west. She took his hand.
Well, I'm not too proud to take extra insurance if it's offered. Another donation will be accepted, if you feel up to it.
He blinked, feeling the tempo of his pulse rise.
You mean right now?
She nodded.
When else?
I was hoping you'd say that.
He grinned and reached for her, but she held up a hand to stop him.
Just a minute, she said. What kind of a girl do you think I am? Candlelight and champagne may be in short supply up here, but a femme generally appreciates at least a little foreplay.
Fine by me, Fibbon said.
He turned around to present his back for grooming.
Do me, then I'll do you.
But she shook her head.
Not that kind of foreplay, Fibbon. I had in mind something much more stimulating.
She reached behind the tree and brought forth a cylindrical object made of carved wood, one end covered by a tautly stretched skin. Fibbon's eyes widened.
A drum?
She sat with the little handmade instrument between her knees.
It's your own damn fault, Fibbon Bulger. You showed me something special, and from now on, I'll never be satisfied with anything less.
Her deft fingers rattled off a quick rhythm.
Dance, she said. Please?
Fibbon sighed. Obviously, she wasn't kidding. This choreomaniac chimmy was crazy, of course, whatever the uplift board said. It seemed to be the type he fell for.
There are some ways we'll never be like humans, he thought,
as he picked up a branch and shook it tentatively. He dropped it and tried another. Already he felt flushed and full of energy. Sylvie tapped the drum, starting with a rapid, exhilarating tempo that made his breath sharpen. The shine in her eyes seemed to warm his blood.
This is as it should be. We are our own selves, he knew.
Fibbon took the branch in a two-handed grip and brought it down on a nearby log, sending leaves and brush exploding in all directions.
Ook,
he said. His second blow was harder, though, and as the beat picked up, his next cry came with more enthusiasm. The morning fog had evaporated. No thunder rolled. The uncooperative universe had not even provided a single cloud in the sky. Still, Fibbon figured he could probably manage this time without the lightning. Chapter 78 Galactics. In Gubru Military Encampment 16, the chaos at the top had begun affecting those lower down in the ranks. There were squabbles over allotments and supplies, and over the behavior of common soldiers,
whose contempt for the support staff reached new and dangerous levels. At afternoon prayer time, many of the Talon soldiers put on the traditional ribbons of mourning for the lost progenitors and joined the priestly chaplain to croon in low unison. The less devout majority, who generally kept a respectful silence during such services, now seemed to make it a special occasion for gambling and loud commotion. Sentries preened and purposely sent loose feathers drifting in strong breezes so they would pass distractingly among the faithful. Discordant noises could be heard during work, during maintenance, during training exercises. The stoop colonel in charge of the eastern encampments happened to be on an inspection tour and witnessed this disharmony in person. It wasted no time on indecision. At once the stoop colonel ordered all personnel of Encampment 16 assembled. Then the officer gathered the camp's chief administrator and the chaplain by its side upon a platform, and addressed those gathered below.
"Let it not be said, bandied, rumored, that Gubru soldiers have lost their vision. Are we orphans, lost, abandoned, or members of a great clan? What were we, are we, shall we be, warriors, builders, but most of all, proper carriers of tradition?"
For some time the stoop colonel spoke to them so, joined in persuasive song by the camp's administrator and its spiritual adviser, until at last the shamed soldiers and staff began to coo together in a rising chorus of harmony. They made the effort, invested the time, one small united regiment of military bureaucrats and priests, and struggled as one to overcome their doubts. For a brief while, then, there did indeed take shape a consensus. Chapter 79. Gaylet. Even among those rare and tragic cases, wolfling species, there have existed crude versions of these techniques. While primitive, their methods also involved rituals of combat of honor, and by such means kept aggressiveness and warfare under some degree of restraint. Take, for example, the most recent clan of wolflings, the humans of Sol III. Before their discovery by galactic culture, their primitive tribes often used ritual to hold in check the cycles of ever-increasing violence normally to be expected from such an unguided species. No doubt these traditions derived from warped memories of their long-lost patron race. Among the simple but effective methods used by pre-contact humans, see citations, were the method of counting coup for honor among the American Indians, trial by champion among the medieval Europeans, and deterrence by mutual assured destruction among the continental tribal states. Of course, these techniques lacked the subtlety, the delicate balance, and homeostasis of the modern rules of behavior laid out by the Institute for Civilized Warfare.
"That's it. Break time. I'm putting a T on it. Enough."
Gaylet blinked, her eyes unfocusing, as the rude voice drew her back out of her reading trance. The library unit sensed this and froze the text in front of her. She looked to her left. Sprawled in the beanbag, her new partner threw his data well aside and yawned, stretching his lanky, powerful frame.
"Time for a drink," he said lazily.
"You haven't even made it through the first edited summary," Gaylet said. He grinned.
I don't know why we've got to study this shit. The ETs will be surprised if we remember to bow and recite our own species name. They don't expect neo-chimps to be geniuses, you know."
"Apparently not. And your comprehension scores will certainly reinforce the impression."
That made him frown momentarily. He forced a grin again.
"You, on the other hand, are trying so hard.
I'm sure the E.T.'s will find it terribly cute.
Touché, Gaylord thought.
It hadn't taken the two of them very long to learn how to cut each other where it hurt.
Maybe this is yet another test. They are seeing how far my patience can be stretched before it snaps.
Maybe, but not very likely. She had not seen the suzerain of propriety for more than a week. Instead, she had been dealing with a committee of three pastel-tinged gubru, one from each faction. And it was the blue-tinted Talon soldier who strutted foremost at these meetings. Yesterday, they had all gone down to the ceremonial site for a rehearsal. Although she was still undecided whether to cooperate in the final event, Gaylord had come to realize that it might already be too late to change her mind. The seaside hill had been sculpted and landscaped so that the giant power plants were no longer visible. The terraced slopes led elegantly upward, one after another, marred only by bits of debris brought in by the steady autumnal winds. Already bright banners flapped in the easterlies, marking the stations where the Neo-Chimp representatives would be asked to recite, or answer questions, or submit to intense scrutiny. There at the site, with the Gubru standing close by, Iron Grip had been to all outward appearances a model student. And perhaps it had been more than a wish to curry favor that had made him so uncharacteristically studious. After all, these were facts that had direct bearing upon his ambitions. That afternoon, his quick intelligence had shone. Now, though, with them alone together under the vast vault of the new library, other aspects of his nature came to the fore.
"So, how about it?" Iron Grip said as he leaned over her chair and gave her a Cyprian leer. "Want to step outside for some air? We could slip into the eucalyptus grove and..."
"There are two chances of that," she snapped. "Fat and slim."
He laughed.
"Put it off until the ceremony, then, if you like it public. Then it'll be you and me, babe, with the whole five galaxies watching."
He grinned and flexed his powerful hands. His knuckles cracked. Gaylord turned away and closed her eyes. She had to concentrate to keep her lower lip from trembling.
"Rescue me," she wished against all hope or reason.
Logic chided her for even thinking it. After all, her white knight was only an ape, and almost certainly dead. Still, she couldn't help crying inside.
"Fibbin, I need you. Fibbin, come back."
Chapter 80. Robert. His blood sang. After months in the mountains, living as his ancestors had, on wits and his own sweat, his toughened skin growing used to the sun and the scratchy rub of native fibers, Robert still had not yet realized the changes in himself. Not until he puffed up the last few meters of the narrow, rocky trail and crossed in 10 long strides from one watershed to another. "The top of Rwanda Pass. I've climbed 1,000 meters in 2 hours, and my heart is scarcely beating fast." He did not really feel any need to rest. However, Robert made himself slow down to a walk. Anyway, the view was worth lingering over. He stood atop the very spine of the Mulin Range. Behind him, to the north, the mountains stretched eastward in a thickening band, and westward toward the sea, where they continued in an archipelago of fat, towering islands. It had taken him a day and a half of running to get here from the caves, and now he saw ahead of him the panorama he would have yet to cross to reach his destination. "I'm not even sure how to find what I'm looking for." Athoclena's instructions had been as vague as her own impressions of where to send him. More mountains stretched ahead of him,
dropping away sharply toward a dun-colored steppe, partially obscured by haze. Before he reached those plains, there would be still more rise and fall over narrow trails that had only felt a few score feet, even during peacetime. Robert was probably the first to come this way since the outbreak of war. The hardest part was over, though. He didn't enjoy downhill running, but Robert knew how to take the jolting, fall-stepping so as to avoid damaging his knees, and there would be water lower down. He shook his leather canteen and took a sparing swallow. Only a few deciliters remained, but he was sure they'd do. He shaded his eyes and looked beyond the nearest purple peaks, to the high slopes where he would have to make his camp tonight. There would be streams, all right, but no lush rainforests like on the wet northern side of the Moulin. And he would have to think about hunting for food soon, before he sallied forth onto the dry savanna. Apache braves could run from Taos to the Pacific in a few days and not eat anything but a handful of parched corn along the way. He wasn't an Apache brave, of course. He did have a few grams of vitamin concentrate with him, but for the sake of speed, he had chosen to travel light. For now, quickness counted more than his grumbling stomach. He skirted aside where a recent landslide had broken the path. Then he set a slightly faster pace as the trail dropped into a set of tight switchbacks. That night Robert slept in a moss-filled notch just above a trickling spring, wrapped in a thin silk blanket. His dreams were slow and as quiet as he imagined space might be, if one ever got away from the constant humming of machines. Mostly it was the stillness in the empathy net, after months of living in the riot of the rainforest, that lent a soft loneliness to his slumber. One might ken far in an empty land such as this, even with senses as crude as his. And for the first time, there was not the harsh, metaphorically, almost metallic, hint of alien minds to be felt off in the northwest. He was shielded from the Gubru, and from the humans and Chims, for that matter. Solitude was a strange sensation. The strangeness did not evaporate by the dawn's light. He filled his canteen from the spring and drank deeply to take the edge off his hunger. Then the run began anew. On this steeper slope, the descent was wearing, but the miles did go by quickly. Before the sun was more than halfway toward the zenith, the high steppe had opened up around him. He ran across rolling foothills now, kilometers falling behind him like thoughts barely contemplated and then forgotten. And as he ran, Robert probed the countryside. Soon he felt certain that the expanse held odd entities, somewhere out there beyond or among the tall grasses. If only kenning were more of a localizing sense. Perhaps it was this very imprecision that had kept humans from ever developing their own crude abilities. Instead, we concentrated on other things. There was a game that was often played, both on Earth and among interested galactics. It consisted of trying to reconstruct the fabled lost patrons of humanity, the half-mythical starfarers who supposedly began the uplift of human beings, perhaps 50,000 years ago, and then departed, in mystery, leaving the job only half done. Of course, there were a few bold heretics, even among the galactics, who held that the old Earthling theories were actually true, that it was somehow possible for a race to uplift itself, to evolve star-faring intelligence and pull itself up by its bootstraps out of darkness and into knowledge and maturity. But even on Earth, most now thought the idea quaint. Patrons uplifted clients, who later took their own turn uplifting newer pre-sentients. It was the way and had been ever since the days of the progenitors, so long ago. There was a real dearth of clues. Whoever the patrons of man might have been, they had hidden their traces well, and for good reason. A patron race who abandoned a client was generally branded as an outlaw. Still, the guessing game went on. Certain patron clans were ruled out because they would never have chosen an omnivorous species to raise. Others were unsuited to living on Earth, even for short visits, because of gravity or atmosphere or a host of other reasons. Most agreed that it couldn't have been a clan which believed in specialization, either. Some uplifted their clients with very specific goals in mind. The Uplift Institute demanded that any new sapient race be able to pilot starships, exercise judgment and logic, and be capable of patron status itself someday. But beyond that, the Institute put few constraints on the types of niches into which client species might be made to fit. Some were destined to become skilled craftsmen, some philosophers, and some mighty warrior castes. But humanity's mysterious patrons had to have been generalists, for man, the animal, was very much a flexible beast. Yes, and for all the vaunted flexibility of the Timbrimi, there were some things not even those masters of adaptation could even think of doing. Such as this, Robert thought. A covey of native birds exploded into the air in a flurry of beating wings as Robert ran across their feeding grounds. Small, skittering things felt the rumble of his approach and took cover. A herd of animals, long-legged and fleet, like small deer, darted away, easily outdistancing him. They happened to flee southward, the direction he was going anyway, so he followed them. Soon Robert was approaching where they had stopped to feed again. Once more they bolted, opened a wide berth behind them, then settled down again to browse. The sun was getting high. It was a time of the day when all the plains animals, both the hunters and the hunted, tended to seek shelter from the heat. Where there were no trees, they scraped the soil in narrow runnels to find cooler layers, and lay down in what shade there was to wait out the blazing sun. But on this day, one creature did not stop. It kept coming. The pseudo-deer blinked in consternation as Robert approached again. Once more they arose and took flight, leaving him behind. This time they put a little more distance in back of them. They stood atop a small hill, panting and staring unbelievingly. The thing on two legs just kept coming. An uneasy stir riffled through the herd, a premonition that this just might be serious. Still panting, they fled once more. Perspiration shone like oil on Robert's olive skin. It glistened in the sunlight, quivering in droplets that sometimes shook loose with the constant drumming of his footsteps. Mostly, though, the sweat spread out and coated his skin and evaporated in the rushing wind of his own passage. A dry southeasterly breeze helped it change state into vapor, sucking up latent heat in the process. He maintained a steady, even pace, not even trying to match the sprints of the deer-like creatures. At intervals, he walked and took sparing swigs from his water bag, then he resumed the chase. His bow lay strapped across his back, but for some reason Robert did not even think of using it. Under the noonday sun, he ran on and on. Mad dogs and Englishmen, he thought, and Apache, and Bantu, and so many others. Humans were accustomed to thinking that it was their brains which distinguished them so from the other members of Earth's animal kingdom, and it was true that weapons and fire and speech had made them the lords of their home world long before they ever learned about ecology or the duty of senior species to care for those less able to understand. During those dark millennia, intelligent but ignorant men and women had used fires to drive entire herds of mammoths and sloths and so many other species over cliffs, killing hundreds for the meat contained in one or two. They shot down millions of birds so the feathers might adorn their ladies. They chopped down forests to grow opium. Yes, intelligence in the hands of ignorant children was a dangerous weapon. But Robert knew a secret. We did not really need all these brains in order to rule our world. He approached the herd again, and while hunger drove him, he also contemplated the beauty of the native creatures. No doubt they were growing rapidly in stature with each passing generation. Already they were far larger than their ancestors had been back when the Burrali slew all the great ungulates which used to roam these plains. Someday they might fill some of those empty niches. Even now they were already far swifter than a man. Speed was one thing, but endurance was quite another matter. As they turned to flee him again, Robert saw that the herd members had begun to look a little panicky. The pseudo-deer now wore flecks of foam around their mouths. Their tongues hung out, and their rib cages heaved in rapid tempo. The sun beat down. Perspiration beaded and covered him in a thin sheen. This evaporated, leaving him cool. Robert paced himself. Tools and fire and speech gave us the surplus. They gave us what we needed to begin culture. But were they all we had? A song had begun to play in the network of fine sinuses behind his eyes, in the gentle squish of fluid that damped his brain against the hard, driving accelerations of every footstep. The throbbing of his heartbeat carried him along like a faithful bass rhythm. The tendons of his legs were like taut, humming bows, like violin strings. He could smell them now, his hunger accentuating the atavistic thrill. He identified with his intended prey. In an odd way, Robert knew a fulfillment he had never experienced before. He was alive. He barely noticed, as he began overtaking the deer, who had collapsed to the ground. Mothers and their fawns blinked in dull surprise as he ran past them without a glance. Robert had spotted his target, and he projected a simple glyph to tell the others to relax, to slip aside, while he chased a big male buck at the head of the herd. "You are the one," he thought. "You have lived well, passed on your genes. Your species does not need you anymore, not as much as I do." Perhaps his ancestors actually used empathy sense quite a bit more than modern man, for now he saw a real function for it. He could ken the growing dread of the buck as one by one its overheated companions dropped aside. The buck put in a desperate burst of speed and leaped far ahead, but then it had to rest, panting miserably to try to cool off, its sides heaving as it watched Robert come on. Foaming, it turned to flee again. Now it was just the two of them. Gimel-high blazed. Robert bore on. A little while later, he brought his left hand to his belt as he ran and loosened the sheath of his knife. Even that tool he chose with some reluctance. What decided him to use it instead of his bare hands was empathy with his prey and a sense of mercy. It was some hours later, his stomach no longer growling urgently, that Robert felt his first glimmerings of a clue. He had begun making his way southwestward in the direction Athaclena had hoped would lead him to his goal. As the day aged, Robert shaded his eyes against the late afternoon glare. Then he closed them and reached forth with other senses. Yes, something was close enough to ken. If he thought of it metaphorically, it came as a very familiar flavor. He headed forth at a jog, following traces that came and went, sometimes cool and sentient, and sometimes as wild as the buck who had shared its life with Robert so recently. When the traces grew quite strong, Robert found himself near a vast thicket of ugly thorn bush. Soon it would be sunset, and there was no way he would be able to chase down the thing emanating those vibrations, not in this dense, hurtful undergrowth. Anyway, he did not want to hunt this creature. He wanted to talk to it. He was sure the being was aware of him now. Robert halted. He closed his eyes again and cast forth a simple glyph. It darted left, right, then plunged into the vegetation. There came a rustle. He opened his eyes. Two dark, glittering pools blinked back at him. "All right," he said softly. "Please come on out now. We had better talk." There was another moment's hesitation. Then there shambled forth a long-armed chim, hairier than most, with thick brows and a heavy jaw. He was dirty and totally naked. There were a few stains that Robert was sure came from caked blood, and it had not come from the chim's own minor scratches. "Well, we are cousins, after all, and vegetarians don't live long on a steppe." When he sensed that the co-mate chim was reluctant to make eye contact, Robert did not insist. "Hello, Jojo," he said softly and with sincere gentleness. "I've come a long way to bring a message to your employer." Chapter 81. Athoclena. The cage consisted of thick wooden slats bound by wire. It hung from a tree branch in a sheltered vale under the leeward shoulder of a simmering volcano. Still, the guy cables holding it in place trembled under occasional gusts of wind, and the cage itself swayed. Its occupant, naked, unshaven, and looking very much the wolfling, stared down at Athoclena with an expression that would have burned even without the loathing he radiated. To Athoclena, it felt as if the little glade were saturated with the prisoner's hatred. She planned to keep her visit as short as possible.
"I thought you would want to know. The Gubru Triumvirate has declared a protocol truce under the rules of war," she told Major Prathachulthorn. "The ceremonial site is now sacrosanct, and no armed force on Garth can act except in self-defense for the duration."
Prathachulthorn spat through the bars.
"So, if we'd attacked when I'd planned, we'd have made it before this."
"I find it doubtful. Even the best plans are seldom executed perfectly, and if we were forced to abort the mission at the last minute, every secret we had would have been revealed for nothing."
"That's your opinion," Prathachulthorn snorted.
Athoclena shook her head.
"But that is not the only or even the most important reason."
She had grown tired of fruitlessly explaining the nuances of galactic punctilio to the Marine officer. But somehow she found the will to try one more time.
"I told you before, Major, wars are known to feature cycles of what you humans sometimes call tit-for-tat, where one side punishes the other side for its last insult, and then that other side retaliates in turn. Left unconstrained, this can escalate forever. Since the days of the progenitors, there have been developed rules which help keep such exchanges from growing out of all proportion."
Prathachulthorn cursed.
"Damn it, you admitted that our raid would have been legal if done in time."
She nodded.
"Legal, perhaps, but it also would have served the enemy well, because it would have been the last action before the truce."
"What difference does that make?"
Patiently, she tried to explain.
The Gubru have declared a truce while still in an overpowering position of strength, Major. That is considered honorable. You might say they win points for that. But their gain is multiplied if they do so immediately after taking damage, if they show restraint by not retaliating. The Gubru are then performing an act of forbearance. They gather credit.
Ha! Prathachulthorn laughed.
That lot of good it'd do them with their ceremonial site in ruins,